Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. This is going to be a 2013 kind of wrap-up show, and today I'm joined by...
Zach Beecham, the reporter and blogger at Think Progress.
Great, thanks for being on with me, Zach. You've been on before, but so we're going to go over a couple different... both look backs at 2013, look aheads at 2014. And I wanted to start with you. What is, for you, the most underappreciated story of 2013?
Well, I wrote about this a bit ago, but I think it's worth reiterating, maybe partially because it's a personal hobby horse and partially because I think it truly is the most important thing of the past probably 20, 30, even 50 years, but it continued in 2013. Namely, the fact that the world is becoming an increasingly much, much better place for virtually everybody on it. Now, by virtually everybody on it, I don't mean every individual person or even every individual country. It would be crazy to say that 2013 was the best year for Syria in the history of Syria. In fact, it was one of the worst ones in recent memory. We're talking in aggregates in terms of overall, if we take an assessment of humanity across the globe and treat everybody's welfare, all persons in each country as being equal, you see that over the course of time, people are doing much, much better. And this is true broadly in virtually every sector of the world. So it's not just if you take this big, broad scale look. It's also if you look at North America as a whole, if you look at Africa as a continent as a whole, if you look at sub-Saharan Africa. And here are the major indicators that make this to be the case. The first big one is life expectancy, which in 1950 was in the mid-40s for the world in general. And by 2011, and we have every reason to believe this trend continued in 2013, it was 70. That's an almost 50% jump. It's extraordinary. And you also see a reduction in poverty, a dramatic reduction in poverty, such that the least number of people in human history right now are poor than at any other point in modern recorded memory. And you can go down the line like this. Crime has decreased dramatically. War in 2013 is not likely to have taken an appreciable uptick to throw off the broader trend that shows that war is declining in the sense of killing less people. In general, less people are dying from war, and there's less discrimination, religious, ethnic, racial, sexual orientation, gender. On all of these scales, we're becoming a better people. And that, I think, is the most important story of 2013. Now, we can talk about the reasons why that's true, but it's worth understanding that these data are almost impossible to argue with.
Right. Now, that seems to me to come down to how you measure human welfare, right? And you mentioned a whole host of different factors, but what do we say, do we want to say is kind of the most important here? Is it life expectancy? Is it number of people dying from war? Is it number of people in poverty? How do you come up with, you know, conclusively that this is an era of increasing human welfare?
Right. So the reason I cited life expectancy particularly is it's a good way of combining a bunch of these different trends, because life expectancy tells you, obviously, how likely you are to live for a long time. And large increases in life expectancy tend to come from lower rates of child mortality, which indicates that less people are being killed by wars and diseases at a young age, and more people are getting to older ages, such that they can, it's not like a blessing or anything, but they can then die of diseases that afflict first world countries more than they afflict developing countries. And so life expectancy is a good proxy for a host of all sorts of other improvements that are preventing people from dying. Now, there are also other metrics that you can use to figure out if people are getting better in a way that's not simply just dying older, that is to say, having longer lives. They're also having happier lives. And the reason we can measure this, as there's a variety, well, there's some questions about this research, but there's a very, very strong vein of research that suggests that as percentage GDP of a country increases, so as it becomes, 100% wealthier, GDP doubles, the overall happiness of its people go up. And you can combine that with measures of poverty, that is to say, number of people living on $1.25 a day. And if you assume that, with very good evidence, that poverty makes people unhappy and unwell, then you can show that these aggregate happiness numbers have been going up as countries' GDPs have been going up over the course of time, particularly in developing countries. And you can show that there are substantially fewer people living on less than $1.25 a day than there were in the past, and that the percentage of people in developing countries living on $1.25 a day has gone down dramatically. So overall, you can say that people are happier and healthier using, you know, those are just a fraction of the metrics that you could use, but I think those are some of the most important ones.
Okay, so I'm generally a skeptic of happiness research, and I would like to ask you how, so is there a certain point when we're looking at, you know, developing countries, is there a certain point in the industrialization process where increasing GDP doesn't necessarily add to happiness? Because the happiness research that I'm skeptical of largely comes out of industrialized nations. So, for example, there's the studies that show if you live in the United States and you win the lottery, it doesn't make you measurably happier. Even though I think that we would clearly agree it makes you better off. Is there a certain point when we're looking at developing countries where increasing GDP doesn't necessarily increase self-reported happiness?
Right. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about this research, which is that if you look at just a straight curve of, you know, increase in numbers in terms of GDP, it really looks like there's no increase happening in developed countries right now. So in the United States and other G20 countries, it looks like they're leveling out in terms of self-reported happiness, while developing countries that are approaching that level are slowly increasing where it looks like all the developed countries are stuck at. But then if you mess with the curve a little bit and do what's called a logarithmic assessment, which tells you about percentage increases in a country's GDP. So as a country goes from, I don't know, let's take a hypothetical example, having a GDP per capita of 32,000, and then it jumps up to having a GDP per capita of 64,000, then you find that even in developed countries, if there's an increase that large, and if you look over time, that increase is that large, there's a measurable and significant uptick in happiness. The point then, the upshot, is that it's not that there's a magic point in which countries are happy or people are made happier by economic growth. It's that large increases in economic growth tend to provide new goods, new standards of living that make people measurably happier. And so when you're in a developed country, it takes so long, given how high your GDP per capita is already, to get one of those big percentage increases that it doesn't look like there's any change because growth isn't happening because of the size of the economy. But when those happen and we really get new technologies, you know, televisions used to be a luxury good not that long ago. Same thing with washing machines. And you can see in a variety of different ways how televisions and washing machines have made people's lives much better that aren't mundane. Washing machines is one very clear example because it's had, arguably, I don't know of any studies that have done this, but it'd be interesting to assess the impact on gender equity from the creation of washing machines. And you could see, theoretically, how there might be a relationship between there. And the point is there's all sorts of subtle ways in which economic growth can create new things, that new things and new ideas, and implement those new ideas in ways that make people happier.
Yeah, I get that. You almost sound like a conservative saying there are, you know, we need to unleash the machine of capitalism and economic growth, and these goods that we can't predict will make our lives better, will, right?
Right. That's the thing. Liberals are liberals, not all leftists, but liberals are capitalists. Right. It's like, I think global capitalism is good. We just need to regulate it a lot.
Right.
And in fact,
managed neoliberal economy.
I don't know about neoliberal. That's one of those terms that I have some questions about.
Okay.
It's probably a different conversation, but we could totally get into that.
Let's not right now. Now, going back to, I think, some of the indicators you were talking about. One of the big things that you said leads to increased life expectancy is decreases in the child mortality rate, mm-hmm. which is caused by, you know, I'm not entirely sure what causes that, but I'm going to guess, you know, increases in advanced medicine making their way to impoverished countries, better medical procedures, things of that nature, cleaner water, better infrastructure in general. Now, if we if we segment out the child mortality rate, can we say it? I mean, it's difficult to do that, obviously. In some places where, you know, statistical record keeping isn't up to our Western standards. But if we segment out child mortality rate, is life expectancy of people who don't die within 2 years of birth, or I'm not sure how you calculate child mortality. If people who don't die in early childhood, are those life expectancies increasing as well?
Yes. So usually it's calculated by under 5 years of age. Infant mortality is over 1 year.
Okay.
It looks like there's an increase across the board.
Because that would speak to me of kind of, once you're born and healthy and expected to actually live a life, is your life still getting better?
Yes. Yes, the answer appears to be yes, in part because a lot of the diseases that might not kill you, but still afflict your life and make you miserable over the course of time, the incidence of them is also decreasing. And the ones that are deadly are also becoming more manageable. HIV/AIDS is the classic example here, right? Like, in terms of infection rates since 2005, when the international community really made an effort to try to start treating HIV/AIDS in developing countries, the rates have gone down about 21%. The death rates have gone down 21% because of access to antiretrovirals. And so AIDS isn't just a disease you get as a child. Obviously, right. It's a disease that many adults contract, or young adults. And it's a disease that, you know, very often fatal, at least in the past, before widespread, and still today, but before widespread availability of antiretrovirals was much more deadly and much more debilitating in terms of the way it affected you while you were still alive. So, and there are many other diseases we could go through. Tuberculosis rates, for example, are down pretty substantially. But the underlying point is the causal one that you raised earlier, right? It's why is this happening? And I think the most interesting and the most true answer, at least according to the development economists I've read and talked to, is better government. And it's these ideas that you mentioned, you know, the germ theory of medicine was what caused the big increase in public health in Western countries because, you know, it gave you actually good medical treatments for the diseases that were afflicting newly industrializing countries at the time. But it takes governments to implement them, widespread public health measures. And it takes collective action to be able to do something like create massive, big sewage systems. At least that's been the case historically in virtually all of these places. And so by better governments, I don't necessarily mean more massive ones. It's not like a bureaucracy. It's really a combination of a dedicated and significant investment in public health and having a government that's accountable through democratic institutions and real rights protections that essentially forces political leaders to start paying attention to what its citizens want, which is very often medicine and health. People don't like dying. And so when you've developed better social infrastructures, more competent, well-equipped governments that are also combined with good structures for governing, then that's when you see the most massive increases of public health and public well-being. And you can see that in developed countries. If you look at the history of the implementation of medicine in Western countries and East Asian countries, and you know some South American ones too, and you can see that in developing countries where there are a fair number actually, of democratic countries that just aren't all that wealthy, and they've seen, despite not huge increases in GDP in some cases, massive, massive increases in public health, in part because of this dedicated campaign by the government to make its people's lives better.
Right. I would, yeah, emphasize like you did, this is largely outside of our American left-right divide, and I think it speaks to how good I think that our civil society is in that, like, the worst that our government gets, it's still a functioning government, right?
Right.
And that's not what a lot of developing countries have. And it's not really a left-right thing. It's just a lot of countries around the world just don't have functioning institutions and civil societies like we've built in the West, and for a whole host of reasons, a lot of them related to previous behavior by Western governments, but that the kind of building of civil societies and building institutions that work is key, I would say, in your, what you've been talking about, kind of the last 50 years of development in developing countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to have zones outside government in addition to the government itself that are doing the actual lobbying of the government, you know, people who participate in elections and so on. You do need things like political parties or some kind of organized political activity, which is essentially a civil society thing. So yeah, I agree that that's true. And I also think that this is part of the reason why this is I want to call this an underreported story, is that everything in the United States focuses on the short-term dysfunction and problems in our government on the whole. We talk a lot about things like the government shutdown or problems in Obamacare implementation, and these are all like really real serious issues, and there's a reason why they're leading the headline, which is that, or they're leading the headlines, which is that they're important, and that they're especially important to discuss in a democracy where people do affect and change their votes on the basis of things like the way the parties behave and the way that they act when they have power. But if what we care about, and this is certainly to me the most important thing in the world, what matters is the welfare of every human being on Earth weighed equally, then 2013 was an extraordinary year, wherein virtually, I mean, we're not virtually everybody, but on the whole, humanity was doing much better than it's done in the past, even while there's a lot of room to improve. It's not like we've fixed every problem in the world. We have a lot more left to do as a species, but what it shows is if you take the broad scale view and really think about our year in context, as opposed to thinking about, you know, what's the most important thing based on the headlines today, then I think we should really take a second to appreciate the past year and how good it was for most of us.
And apparently, generally, the last couple decades in general around the world have been decades in which human welfare has massively increased, right?
Yes.
And like you said, it might not be the case that we have data on 2013, but it would be hard to find any trends that might have reversed those advances that we've been seeing.
No. I mean, I've heard arguments that Syria is like the battle deaths from Syria are likely to slightly uptick war deaths. And some people, there's some debate among analysts as to whether that constitutes, you know, a counter trend to the decline in war deaths. But that's the closest thing I've heard to actual pushback suggesting that. I mean, there's a few others, right? Is that in terms of discrimination, there's been an uptick in anti-Semitic incidents in Europe. That's certainly troubling, right? You can list off a lot of these different things that are counter trends, you know, that
the anti-homosexual laws in Uganda and Russia, for example.
Right. It's not, again, that the world is rosy and perfect and everything's proceeding on a straight line about things getting better. Every year, some things get a little bit better and some things get a little bit worse. It's a question of making an on-balance aggregate assessment if we're doing context comparisons.
Right.
And that's what I was trying to get at with that entire thing.
Yeah. No, I think that is definitely a good story. I want to move on now to what I consider to be an underreported story, and compared to what we just discussed, it might be a little bit of navel-gazing, but it's kind of in keeping with what the American news media looks at in American society, and that's that the American economy was surprisingly resilient in 2013. At this time last year, we were closing up a quarter that was initially reported to have negative economic growth. And by almost every forecast, in 2013, we were set to plunge into a recession, which is to say that the first quarter of 2013 was projected to also be a time of negative economic growth. And two quarters of negative economic growth is considered to be a recession. The fourth quarter of 2012 was later revised upwards to have slight, not really significant, but slightly positive economic growth. And the first, second, and third quarters of 2013 saw economic growth kind of rise into encouraging, let's say, levels. That's not to say that the economy was booming in 2013, but the combination of the fiscal cliff and sequestration was projected by almost all analysts to take a significant chunk out of economic growth and possibly plunge us into a recession. That didn't happen. And I wanted to get your take on this, because in the American economic discourse, we saw a narrative being set up of kind of austerity versus economic growth and possibly monetarism on the other side. So I think that there are a couple things in play here. One, it could be that sequestration and the fiscal cliff did not take as large a chunk out of the economy as was projected to happen. Two, and this is the theory put forward by, and has been being put forward by Scott Sumner and kind of modern monetarists over the past few years, which is that the Federal Reserve can actually be stupendously effective even at close to the zero lower bound. Or three, there were unforeseen developments in the economy that led us to stronger than projected economic growth. And I wanted to get your take on what sounds the most plausible to what might have happened in 2013.
Right. So my impulse, this probably won't surprise you, is that it's some combination of option two and option three, which is that I do think there's an interesting, and again, in keeping with the theme of this conversation, underreported near consensus between center-left and center-right writers and economists about the importance and value of Federal Reserve cash infusions into the economy in this particular economic situation. It seems like, and Kevin, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I think you might, that most of the people on both sides of the broadly partisan divide that I read who focus on economic writing and economic issues tend to think that the Federal Reserve, the case for a more active and more aggressive Federal Reserve is fairly clear. And that it, in fact, could be doing a lot more than it could be to help both growth and unemployment by pumping more money into the economy. Now, it's been, as compared to what it was in the past, in 2013, comparatively aggressive in terms of intervening to improve the economic situation. It looks like that's about to, pardon the pun, taper off. But that doesn't mean that they weren't in the past and that didn't contribute a fair amount to growth in the past year. And now another thing on, and one issue I think on the third point that's worth talking about is that the American economy may have done a bit and a fair amount better than we expected because Europe didn't fall apart. The European economic situation was projected by many people to continue and deepen and get worse. Now it's, according to nobody, we're out of the woods in terms of dealing with the, you know, the structural problems in the euro and the resilience of European countries in the face of economic downturns. But it seems to me that since we depend heavily in a global economy on our major global trading partners, including the European Union very prominently, that an EU collapse would have been factored into some of the projections about the United States economy being weak, or not, if not quite collapse, than a worse situation that happened over the course of this year where there were some fairly modest signs of improvement.
That certainly is plausible. I think the European story is both underreported and underappreciated kind of in the past few years by a lot of American economic analysts. Well, I mean, I'm not sure how serious of analysts, but let's say the public media. The fact that fair number, and not just doomsayers, have been projecting that the eurozone would collapse over the last few years. The collapse of the eurozone has been a fairly plausible scenario over the last few years, and that hasn't happened, I think, probably helps the American economic story here, because, you know, we've seen in the past, in, I think it was 2011, when the sovereign debt crisis was going on, that took a fairly large chunk out of American economic growth as well. You know, the Greek crisis, the lending spikes, or the cost of lending spikes in Spain and Italy, those did cause a mini panic in the American economy. And the fact that we've seen resilience out of Europe certainly helps us over here, because in the modern international economy is so interconnected at this point. I think that it's of the kind of scenarios that I gamed out, I think it's a combination of actually all three. I don't particularly on sequestration in the fiscal cliff. You know, at this time last year and throughout January, I thought that sequestration was going to be completely repealed, no questions asked, no replacements put in place, because I thought that the American economy was on the precipice of a recession. And I would say I was wrong about that. The American economy wasn't on the precipice of a recession, and sequestration did not take a large enough chunk out to push us into recession. Now, that's not to say that sequestration has been the greatest thing in the world, but if you're a conservative, and I am, and you think that medium-term debt is an important enough issue to try and tackle even now, sequestration and even the new Ryan Murray budget replacement puts us on a path to basically tame our medium-term debt problem. You know, over the next 10 years, we're going to average between 2 and 3% of GDP in debt, or in deficit, and add that to the debt, which is a fairly manageable thing for a modern economy. Whereas prior to sequestration, and sequestration was something that I thought would, like I said, would be canceled because politicians would be worried about the threat of recession. But prior to sequestration, that we were projected to average between 5 and 6%, I believe, deficits every year and add a fairly significant amount to our public debt. So I think that the continuing implementation of sequestration and the minor cancellation of it in the most recent budget deal hasn't taken as large of a chunk out of the economy as expected. And I think that combined with aggressive Federal Reserve action, and I will say aggressive Federal Reserve action in the face of what a lot of Republican lawmakers have wanted the Fed to do, has kind of combined to give us this minorly resilient economy that looks like we might be on track to get back to an actually flourishing economy in the next 2 years.
Right, and that's the part that I'm cautious about, and the reasons are twofold. First, as I hinted at the end of my answer, the Federal Reserve looks like, we can't be certain, but it looks like from recent announcements that they're likely to slow down on their interventions aimed at promoting growth, which may slow some of these positive trends we've been talking about. Second, we're not out of the woods in terms of historical growth norms yet. We're still fairly below the post-war, by which I mean post-World War II, American economic average. And part of that is I think that the basic economic situation since 2008, and again, me, I'm the liberal in this conversation, so I'm going to say what's expected here, but not just because it's my role, but also because I think it's true, is that we're still stuck to a certain degree in a demand-side recession wherein people don't quite have the ability and the employment and the money necessary to make investments in the economy that continue the virtuous cycle of growth where people spend and that spending gets reinvested in productive economic uses, which in turn generate more wealth and cause people to spend more and so on and so forth. And that's not happening right now, and part of that really is sequestration, government spending. It's not just that sequestration slashes government programs for the needy, and we could go through a laundry list of things that and of people who have been directly and irrevocably harmed by programs slashed by sequestration. But it's also that government jobs have fallen dramatically under Obama, in fact, more so even than they did under, substantially more so than they did under any of the recent Republican presidents. And that's, you know, not Obama's decision personally. It's, you know, part of the budget compromises and sequestration and so on. But so it's not like I'm saying Obama is the big government killer. That would be sort of silly. But I think that it's important to bear in mind that government employment has in the past been a tool of getting unemployment down and consequently to a certain degree, getting healthy money into the economy and dealing and improving growth over the course of time. And we're not using that tool. Part of that also is state level budget cutting. And as a consequence, you know, economic growth is much slower than it should be. And it makes the economy more vulnerable in the case of unforeseen bad things, say Eurozone collapse. The other really scary scenario, which we haven't talked about, is Chinese economic growth slowing down dramatically. That would be very bad for us, even though some people don't seem to think that's true, but it would be. And until we get on better track, I think it's not quite safe to say that sequestration hasn't taken a significant toll.
Certainly. I mean, yes. Sequestration, I think that in the best case conservative argument, certainly takes a chunk out of welfare today and puts it into tomorrow, which is, by the Congressional Budget Office, 2020, or 2018, I think, is when sequestration is projected to add to the American economy rather than be subtracting from the American economy. And yes, I would say that to President Obama's credit, you would probably say to his detriment, he appears to be fairly serious about the medium-term deficit. He, I think in 2010, around there, put out a White House plan for deficit reduction, which was roughly 3-to-1 spending cuts to tax increases, which is about what we've had if you count the fiscal cliff tax, tax expiration on the upper income earners. As if you count that as a tax hike, you get about what President Obama wanted out of quote-unquote deficit reduction. And he, you know, I think that, I don't know if he's tricked Democrats or progressives or whoever into thinking that he's not someone who cares about the deficit, because it certainly seems that he is, at least by the actions that he's taken, the legislation that he signed into law. And certainly we can say that compared to the 2011 budget control agreement, he wants less deficit reduction now, more in the future, but he still wants deficit reduction over the medium term, over the 5 to 10 year span. And whether or not that would be a trick on Republicans doesn't really have an effect on what's actually happened, which is that we've gotten medium-term deficit reduction. And like I said about the underreported story, we've gotten medium-term deficit reduction and an economy that was better than we expected it to be with our medium-term deficit reduction.
Right. I think, to me, the lessons of that are a little bit different. First, I would say, briefly, on the point about Obama, I don't think it's escaped liberals and leftists that Obama has an interest in cutting the deficit. I think it's, in fact, one of the main focal points of left-liberal criticism of him, is that he's over-concerned with debt and deficit problems, which I personally and many other people like me don't really think is a big deal right now, and especially for the reasons that you've just illustrated, which is namely that it's taken, I mean, I would argue fairly dramatic cuts in government in terms of the welfare of people who are being hurt by not having government services provided to them. But it looks like right now it's fairly easy to get a hold of these debt and deficit problems. And not only that, we're not even close to anything like a long-term crisis, especially given that we have the global reserve currency and our own nice little Federal Reserve that can print money whenever we need it, and inflation is not even close to a problem in the American economy. So as a consequence, what this all suggests to me, that the continued economic growth, but slow economic growth by historical standard, in the face of significant improvements in the medium-term, long-term debt projections, is that we really need to stop focusing on the debt at this particular point in time and deal with the unemployment, the unemployment crisis, the inequality crisis. I think both of which can fairly be labeled real serious problems, deep problems for the American economy, and start addressing those, even if it, you know, takes a bit of a chunk out of this rosy debt and deficit picture, because we've shown that we have the ability as a political system to sort of get that one under control.
Right. Here's what I wonder, and this might be, well, we'll get into our 2014 projections quickly, but the Ryan Murray budget kind of takes sequestration off the table, right? It allows Congress and members of Congress to say, we've addressed sequestration, we're done with it now. So I wonder if in the near term that means that they'll be able to focus, I suppose, on current and the underemployment in the American economy, trying to get people back to work, focusing a bit more on the near-term economic picture rather than the medium-term economic picture. So I think that that's something to watch out for 2014. But since we're already running a bit long, I want to get into your projection for 2014 and what you think a major story that we need to be focusing on should be.
Right. So if 2013 and 2012 and the previous years in national security policy were the years of the drone, where unmanned military technology started becoming something that the public really concerned itself with and became a huge focus of our debate about our foreign policy and our counterterrorism policy, then I think that 2014 will be the year that we start having serious, non-jokey conversations in big public fora about military robotics. The distinction between drones and robots being that robots have the ability to guide and fire on their own, whereas drones do not. And the reasons I think this will become a big deal in 2014 are that it is, according to some signs that only right now a small community of people pay attention to, is about to become a massive topic at the United Nations. From what we can tell, France, a not insignificant global player, is leading a broad movement with interest from a variety of different countries around the world to start considering arms control on robots. Military robotics is making dramatic advancements. I mean, we saw this a while ago. P.W. Singer wrote a book called Wired for War in the late 2000s, which illustrated that already we were approaching a time in which people could use robots to kill each other during conflict. But now, this movement didn't come out of nowhere. There was a massive, essentially grassroots push by Human Rights Watch and other allied organizations, something called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, that has brought this issue onto the international agenda. And in May, there's going to be a big summit in Geneva about arms control agreements for robots. Now, are we likely to see robots in the field next year? No. In fact, the DoD has a moratorium on imposing them right now. But that doesn't mean that there aren't elements of the U.S. government and many other foreign governments that aren't interested in them. And when this stuff starts to come up on the international docket, as you're seeing happening right now, you see pushback and you see advocacy for them, which started, again, roughly late last year and this year in 2013, where people were arguing that robots are actually better warfighters than humans, and more humane, more ethical. Essentially, we should be using them as opposed to trying to ban them or severely limit them, which is what the advocates and the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, in case you couldn't tell from the name, want. And so this is a major issue about the future of war, what war is going to look like, how we deal with the use of new technologies in war. And it's one that's going to stop being about Terminator jokes and start being about real policy hard choices that cause us to reevaluate more broadly how we understand the future of emerging technologies and the military in a variety of different ways.
Now, when you say robots, just to clarify here, you're saying that the difference between a drone and a robot is that a robot can choose its target and fire on its own.
Right. Or it has a human, what's referred to as in the loop or on the loop. Those mean technically different things, but to simplify, it means that there's a person who is watching the robot and is capable of either firing for it, that's not really true robotic fire control, or overriding it. That is to say, if the robot makes a target selection,
right,
then the person who's watching through the robot's eyes can say, no, that's a civilian, and push stop.
So it's a difference, but, I mean, in that case, it seems like a difference between a human saying yes and a human saying no.
Right, that's the on-the-loop, in-the-loop distinction. Right. It's like very confusing terminology that people use in these debates, but right, there's also theoretically a world in which humans grant full fire control to robots and just watch. And if the robot is behaving really poorly, there's like a self-destruct button or something like that. It all depends on how the technology exists right now. But none of this technology is
deployed in the field right now, is it?
Well, some sort of. For example, in Iraq in 2005, we had robotic ground machines. They were more like drones, but there were a few units of them. It was called the Talon Swords. I mean, 2005, right? American manufacturing would suggest that we're closer to this technology than we think. South Korea has border emplacements. Now they're stationary. They're not robots that could move around. But they have automated border emplacements on the border with North Korea that if anything comes, that these essentially stationary robots have the ability to make determinations as to whether this thing has violated the demilitarized zone and fire on them under certain circumstances. So, and there's also, there are thousands of different kinds of robots that do non-combat tasks in the military right now. So it's just a question of when someone makes a determination that their artificial intelligence algorithm is good enough to allow it to do mobile target selection. Right. And, you know, there's debate about how far away we are from that, but it seems that right now the debate is whether we want to get closer than we are. And that debate is set to explode in 2014.
All right. Wow. Since we're, again, running long, quickly, my projection for 2014 is that, again, more domestically than your outlook, we will see the school choice debate, which I largely use the term school choice to encompass both voucher systems and charter school programs, will become a lot more prominent on the national stage, especially as we move towards the 2016 elections, which might be a bit a long way off, but election cycles get longer and longer. But the expansion of school voucher programs in Louisiana, which kind of took a long time due to the Justice Department intervening, in Louisiana, right, and in Indiana, will provide us, and this is a debate that I don't think is anywhere close to solved. You know, generally, conservatives line up on the school choice side, and progressives line up on traditional public schools side, and we don't have a whole lot of data. It's kind of mixed. There's examples from Washington and Milwaukee and other places showing improvements in test scores, non-improvements in test scores, more money, less money. But I think that these debates in 2014 will become a lot more prominent because we're going to have a lot more data on whether school choice programs actually work for both low-income and middle-income students.
Right. I think what's interesting about this issue, particularly as you raise the specter of there being more data here, is that it's something that divides the left in a way that it doesn't divide the right. Particularly charter schools. Vouchers are less controversial, I'd say, on the left. But charter schools are an issue that get into this broader teachers' unions, are they good or bad, or do they need to be reformed to a certain degree debate, which is, I don't know if you follow internecine left-liberal fighting on this issue, but it's one of the most acrimonious debates I've ever seen between people who broadly agree about the world,
right,
in terms of, you know, like broad scale what they'd like to see the government do. And
there's actually, I think, less divide among conservatives, and this might be for harmful reasons, but conservatives are generally in favor of charter schools, even when it means increased government spending. And there are two interpretations of that. One is that conservatives actually do believe that school choice increases outcomes for low and middle income students. The other narrative is that conservatives just hate teachers' unions so much that they will spend more government money to see them broken through charter school projects, which I think probably mirrors, kind of mirrors the debate among the left, except there's no debate among the right.
Right, but isn't there also a social conservative element to this, to the you know, the right-wing conversation about it, which is namely that government control over where kids go to schools to a certain degree violate the parents' autonomy to raise the children in their traditional intellectual and religious atmosphere, and that more, not charter schools, but vouchers are an issue in part of religious freedom, and not just of, you know, government intervention.
To a certain extent, I think that the homeschooling movement taps into those passions a little more accurately, because, you know, I think it's acknowledged to be kind of controversial to use school vouchers and public money to send your kid to a Catholic school or some kind of religious institution, right? And it's kind of acknowledged that if you're going to send your kid there, maybe you should spend your own money on that. And so the kind of social conservative aspect, I think, that is a little more related to homeschooling than charters or voucher schools.
Yeah. that's interesting, because I remember it being, you know, during a huge debate during the Bush administration about to what extent voucher programs should extend to religious schools.
I mean, they generally do, and I think that that's kind of, it's not very controversial on the Republican side, but I think it's still kind of acknowledged that that's not really what the voucher debate is about.
Right. The main impetus is the stuff about how you improve public schools in general, or schooling, sorry, more broadly.
Right. More schooling than, yeah, exactly.
So does all of this really ultimately get back to the teachers' unions, how do they work sort of debate, right? Like, it seems to me that every one of these conversations, to a certain degree, always comes back to whether or not the power of the union as it exists right now is a beneficial force for the lives of students, and how best to address that question. That is to say, what's the best remedy if unions are too powerful or not powerful enough?
Right.
What should the government do about them? It seems like almost all the other conversations about outcomes are sort of shadow boxing for questions about outcomes of the influence of teachers' unions.
Well, to a certain extent, it's the teachers' unions part plays a huge role in this, but it's not. It's more is kind of, and this obviously varies state to state pretty heavily, but is the public school infrastructure so twisted that it's better to try and just send kids outside of it than to fix the infrastructure? Because it's more than teachers' unions, it's local school boards, it's national mandates, it's regulations, all of these kind of play into it, and teachers' unions are largely seen as this monolith in favor of the status quo, which is not necessarily the case, but they're all largely used as a symbol for that. So it's kind of, is the public school system worth fixing, and is it worth saying we have to send another generation of students through this system that we all agree is producing suboptimal outcomes, or do we allow people to get out of that system and into something that might work better for their students immediately?
Right. Right. See, this is an issue that I know is extremely complicated. And it's interesting that this is all framed, at least the way that you started it, about there being new data coming in about it. Because it seems right now that there's huge debate over what the existing data says.
Right.
And exactly. I wonder if that'll end up being resolved by new information coming in 2014, in part because it seems like so much of this is about people using data to fit with their pre-existing ideology about how best to operate and run schools, and to what extent and in what fashions the government should be involved in the structuring and provision of education.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think that that's true. Largely, people try and fit the data to their worldview, but if enough data comes out on one side, it becomes harder and harder to deny that, right?
Right.
If data keeps coming in and it continues being mixed, we're going to continue seeing the same divide. But it would be heartening to see the data swing one way or the other, even though that might not be the case.
Do you think there's a reason to believe that'll change, that these new experiments, I guess experiments, I don't know, I think that's the right term, in Louisiana and Indiana and other states are likely to give dispositive data one way or the other, or are you just sort of agnostic on that question?
I'm agnostic. I'm hopeful, but agnostic.
Got it. Yeah, because it just, when I observe these conversations, and again, don't participate because I don't know enough about the relevant issues to have a real opinion, there's constant accusations of data manipulation and ignoring particular data points and of finessing different statistical techniques to make the argument weigh on one side or the other, and it really just seems like people have these basic ideological predispositions to either say teachers' unions are really large, the sort of basic status quo and lack of quote-unquote school reform is a good thing, or school reform is necessary, we need to hold teachers accountable, and we need to develop a more expansive vision of how to conduct education that isn't just traditional public schools. And that's always what the argument comes down to, and that is a mirror for some more subtle divisions in economic ideology that people have. Now, this is less true in the left-right divide on it. This is the internal left debate I'm talking about. Mm. The left-right divide seems to me to be, well, in as much as certain parts of the left agree with certain parts of the right here, but it seems to be more broadly along traditional lines that you just described earlier in the conversation. Liberals think traditional public schools and broadly government-provided education is a good thing, and conservatives have much more questions, or many more questions about that.
Yeah. All right, I think that wraps this up. I hope everyone has a great 2014, and my final prediction is going to be that people will continue to fit data to their worldview in 2014.
Yeah, I don't think that's going away in 2014. That's not one of my happy trends.
It's not. Yeah, people are not going to drop all ideology and just say, I'm agnostic now on the data. All right, thanks a lot for joining me, Zach, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you. You too.